Today's featured guest, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of InstitutionalAdvisors.com.
Well, Chris, always good to talk with you and your listeners. The best way to describe our work is, number one, the research was based upon a very extensive review of the history of financial markets, wherever and as far back as I could go. In biblical terms, of course, there's nothing new under the sun, and there's really nothing new under the sun when it comes to financial markets. It's all been tried before, driven by emotions, fear and greed, greed at the top and fear at the bottom. And the evidence out there goes way back in history, and the number one conclusion one would have is that we're in a world where everyone or most players think that the central banks have huge influence and policymakers have a huge influence. Over time, they have, because they've, with their weird theories, have depreciated the dollar, purchasing power of the dollar from when the Fed opened its doors in 1914. Down to about 3 cents, I think, last time I saw it. But on the ordinary business cycle, they've got no influence. And when people are going to speculate in something, the people choose, not the central bank. So this then gets us into a major problem about central banks and their influence. But then just to sort of summarize the other part is that it's one thing to have a model where you're expecting a rally in metals or not a rally in metals. But when you have a forecast like we had for a seasonal low in metal prices and crude oil for sometime around December, I mean, it could have been late November, it could have been early January, but as it turns out. And then you get a rebound out to perhaps around April. That then is a forecast. So then when you get there, you then come in with, well, let's just back up to January. Was the market down when it should be? Yes. Were there signs of distress in the market? Yes, there was. So one model we use is called a capitulation model, and we were getting downside capitulation in, for example, crude oil. And so that confirms that it's bad when it should be bad. And then here going the other way now, we're up approximately the window when one would expect up. And things are getting pretty heady. We're getting upside readings definitely on silver stocks like Pan American Silver. My gosh, fabulous rally. And it's getting very overbought. It also, we have a model called the inverse springboard, and it is giving a sell signal now. So Pan American Silver has been outstanding rally in the sector, and as a leading item, it's worthwhile following it, and it's now giving excessive technical readings. So somewhere within the next week or so, it should roll over. We're also getting not quite the same readings, but not as strong, but similar readings in Standard & Poor's. I like to follow the NYA. That's the whole New York Stock Exchange composite, the whole broad market. And it's up there as well. So the question is now, you've registered some excessive technical readings on the upside at about a time when it was likely. So you adjust your portfolio accordingly. And what we're looking for here on the stock market would be an end to one of the features, which is the phony uptick close. I think that's evidence of the hand of policymakers trying to make the market look more attractive than it is, and it doesn't cost you a lot of money to hold the market up all day long. It costs you a lot less to do a phony uptick close. Well, yesterday didn't have the phony uptick close on volume, so. And so on the S&P or the NYA, when you've got these signals, we then wait for the on a weekly basis to have a lower low than the previous week's low. We're not there yet. That then sort of says that everybody's in and you're getting the working on a trend change. And that would hold for the very hot precious metal stocks as well, on the big ones. You know, smaller stocks are pretty volatile, but the big ones like Pan American Silver, the first week with a lower low would say that the best of the move is in. And gosh, it certainly has been a change in the market, Chris, from the terrible gloom of last December, January. Now, where we stood on this, on the bigger picture, was beginning in November, we put together a couple of studies that argued that the next low, when it came in, would be or could be a cyclical low, end of the cyclical bear, and the beginning of the cyclical bull. And, yeah, very convincing rally when it took off. And you've got the Huey. I think the low was 99, and the high was something like 210. So it's been outstanding. So here was the other thing, Chris. So look back on the terrible stock markets in 2001. And they came under the pressures, and that drove down the precious metal stock prices. And then you had, in 2001, I guess it was, and then also 2008 under that hit. But in each of those cases, the precious metal side stocks had their disaster bottomed and rebounded and enjoyed a fabulous rebound, quite like this one, before the big stock market had bottomed. So let's just look at 2008. I think it was October or November that the gold stocks bottomed and did a huge rally. And then it went down, had another test. But they, of course, as we all know, that problematic market didn't end until March when all of the downside forces cleared. So I think what we're going to get here now on the gold stocks is a correction. And on the base metal side, which has been a terrific party as well, it's not going to be too friendly, I think. So where the gold sector can have a correction on back down, you know, I don't know what level. We'd have to do some technical work there to figure it out. But I think that the base metal side can go right back down and test the lows of January. So we're not quite out of the woods on commodities. Now, this week in commodities, of course, you had a natural rebound in crude oil up to the 43 level, and then it corrected back a bit, and then it rallied up going into the big Doha meeting over the weekend. I think it was on Sunday. So it would be natural that the market would go up into the meeting and go down after the meeting, and crude oil did sell off on Monday morning down to 39, and I thought, oh yeah, that's nice. And it's been following the moving average down. So it had done a nice top and was rolling over, and then all of a sudden there was a huge bid came into the crude oil market, plus probably other commodities, and did a spectacular rally right up to 43 and change, which seems to be matching, you know, pretty close to the previous high. So, and other commodities responded. So actually, I read one professional trader's view here this morning that the government, central banks, who are all concerned that if you've had for ages central bank presence in the credit markets, pushing interest rates this way and mainly down, then in the last decade, it's gradually come out that they have been working the stock markets as well. And it's no big step to consider that they would then start to try and influence the commodity prices. So, but I think in commodities, such influence might be short-lived. They're very overbought at what could be when you would expect to have commodities firm in this season, you know, April, March, April, May, somewhere in here. And you've also had a terrific narrowing of credit spreads. Junk spreads relative to treasuries widened right out to beyond 20% in the problems into January, and one would expect a correction. And it keeps correcting. We're down into the 16s now on that one, a spread. It's come in a long ways, again, tied to commodities. So everything at the moment is up and looking good, and people are excited and happy as can be, but it's at a time that this was likely, and this is how our methods work. Is you, yeah, sometimes it's seasonal, sometimes it's historical, and you'd look for there's going to be a high. We got the high, and then the other one is, are there technical excesses? And yes, there are. So then we just sort of wait patiently for the whole thing to roll over. And as I said, in the precious metal side, it would be a correction within a new and cyclical bull market. And on the ordinary commodity side, it would be, it's been an important rally, but it needs to go down and have a test before one can say that the bear market in commodities that started in 2011 is over. So, Chris, we do live in interesting times.
Thank you for that comprehensive overview. I keep hearing from the blogosphere mongers that the stock market big rally since 2008, 2009 nadir has reached its zenith, and it's all over. From merely a technical vantage point, we've just put in a remarkable double bottom, or what some people refer to as a W bottom. It could potentially, theoretically, lead to new highs in the years ahead.
All I know is it's up when it should be, and it's showing signs of excess. So one has to figure that in the next couple of weeks or so, we get a week where the S&P has a lower low the week before, then the next downtrend comes in. The central bankers are identifying now with commodities that puts them in yet even more riskier condition, because the central bank should not be identified with any move in any item, either bonds or stocks or now commodities, because these things are ultimately outside of their control and will work against what central bankers want to do. It's all a belief system. Mainly Wall Street and certainly academic life, anything that happens is due to policy changes, and that's not the case because, oh, yeah, that's what I was talking about earlier, going back to Roman times, there's evidence that policymakers, governments, respond to market forces. And I have no reason to say that that's any different, but on the near term, they can appear, like this week, with Monday's turnaround in crude oil, they appear to be momentarily successful. But we would just take these things, Chris, on a month-to-month basis. Stock markets, commodities, precious metals are up when they should be and are showing signs of speculation.
I'd like to move on to the precious metals. We read this week that China is pricing gold in terms of yuan, and there's some speculation that this could lead to even a pegging of the yuan to gold later on, and maybe even further cornering of the yellow metal.
Yeah, I read that, and I thought it was, I think it's a good step. I'd like to look at it where you've had these market points, London, Zurich, where they actually did deal with metal. And there's one more. Now it's going to be in China. I think it's a good thing. I don't know that they're out to corner gold. You can have a gold standard without cornering the metal. You just say, okay, here's our point where we will buy and sell gold at this fixed point against this currency. It's been done before. In 1875, the outgoing Grant administration, with a letter, told the Treasury to go back to redeeming currency for gold. And that was, I think, sometime in 1878. And they had a gold market, I think, in New York, Philadelphia, and the New Orleans. There was great concerns going into that date that there wouldn't be enough gold in the treasury. And because there was belief in the that the government would would meet its obligations, then nobody wanted to own gold. So there was more gold came in and currency went out. So this move in China is probably sound and probably a good idea, but it doesn't, to my mind, represent an urge to corner or control gold. They're just going to have a more liquid market, I guess, for the bullion, which is very constructive for gold's history.
I'd like to move on to the Deutsche Bank confession recently, gold and silver rigging. Apparently, officials at Deutsche Bank decided to take on the onus of a confession.
A medieval confession where they were given the equivalent of being racked on the wheel, facing the burning at the stake, so they confessed to whatever their masters wanted to hear. Now, anybody who's been around the gold business for a while would know that on even when London was the market and there was no futures price, there would usually be a couple of dealers who, on any move, would force it to squeeze the shorts or squeeze the longs, whichever way you're going. They'd always like to take the move to an extra bit as far as they could go. So, and it's like they got confessions out of guys for setting a market for LIBOR. And that was always sort of an agreement. Okay, well, that's what we're going to call LIBOR. Okay, well, that's what we're going to call the price of gold at the end of the day. So these are medieval confessions, and I don't think any less of Deutsche Bank on this regard. I think a great deal less of them because they went wild with borrowing, and just take a look at what their stock's been doing. And I think that has very little, that plunge in their stock into January had very little to do with what they were doing in the gold market, more than what they were doing in the loans market. So, no, it satisfies the need in the gold and silver community to have a conspiracy because, you know, my saying on forecasting and back in the day when you'd get a recession, nothing happens unless central bank causes. So back in those days, they believed that a central bank caused the recession to cure inflation. But then they'd get too severe a recession. So it was called an overshoot of policy. Then you have the macroeconomists, and they have a wonderful little phrase called exogeneity. So exogeneity is something that comes from outside of their modeling process. You got the big central bankers, the big guys in the gold business. And you know how you establish fame as a gold guru? All you have to do is say it's going to go to $10,000 and you're famous. our research hasn't sought fame. Chris, we haven't even thought by saying it's going to go to 5,000. But at any rate, whenever a gold bug or silver bug's forecast doesn't work out, immediately it's a conspiracy that some government agent is somehow smart enough to thwart their forecast.
I'd like to direct the discussion a bit to this $10,000 figure, because one of our favorites here on the show, Dr. Lieb, recently announced his forecast for $10,000 to $20,000 gold. He claims that one of the reasons behind that will be China, due to just insatiable demand, cornering the market at some point to, as we were discussing earlier, to fix the yuan on a more stable basis. So instead of pegging it to the U.S. dollar or oil, for that matter, which they have in limited quantities, access in limited quantities, except their neighbor to the north, what they would do is go for the yellow metal. And you're not so keen on that idea.
Well, there's no rational way that any researcher can come up with a number of $10,000. But what you can do, if you've done your research and homework, is notice that on every Great Depression, well, four out of five of them since central banking started in 1694. And in terms of the senior currency, the real price of gold goes down during a big boom, and then it goes up in the following contraction. And this was one of the fascinating things that I found when doing the numbers back in 1980, was that on four out of five Great Depressions, in senior currency terms, the real price of gold went up by 1.7 times. Well, it was sort of like 1.69, but I rounded it out. So this is what we're looking for, and it can be rationally determined that on this depression cycle, the real price of gold could go up by 1.7 times. Now, to pull a number like 10,000 or 20,000 out of the air, it's pulling it out of air.
But I think what many of our sharp guests as well on the show would concur with is that they're looking at several factors at play. They're looking at a devaluation of the global currency system with dollar hegemony under attack. As John Williams here from ShadowStats.com points out regularly, one divided by zero is infinity. That's just the monetary. Then let's look at the fact that since 1980, we've had more than a doubling of the world's populace. Since 1980, access to gold has gone up maybe a hundredfold to many areas of the world, from Russia, China, former communist bloc countries. Transportation has vastly reduced the cost of sending and shipping metals. You know, you can have an eBay gold and silver shipping business that can ship metals around the world to Singapore, Taiwan, Tahiti, Papua Nui, to the Easter Island. There are some factors at play that indicate we may not see an exact 1980 or 1929 style replay, but there could be a confluence of events that lead to extraordinary times that you started off the show with.
Okay, well, let's go back to 1928-29, and one of the reasons for the bull market in stocks then was that the end of the experiment in socialism in many countries in Eastern Europe and even in the United States, this would free up markets and you'd have a whole lot of new retail people. And so that's an old story. Gold is money. No matter what the Keynesians say, gold is money. And the purchasing power of money changes. And when you're in the long expansion, the dynamic expansion of the economy, with rising commodity prices, and this is the part that many gold and silver bugs miss, is that the increased demand for their favorite metal, whether it's gold or silver, and also mixed with currency depreciation, it's not going to affect any other commodity. It's sort of an isolated world if you're a silver bug or a gold bug, and the evil central bank is going to depreciate the currency, and gold's going to go to 10,000. Now, what happens if crude oil goes to the equivalent of 20,000. And crude oil represents energy. You got to have blasting agents and tires and power and all that sort of stuff. So you can have crude oil or gold going to 10,000, but if your costs of mining it are going to 20,000 or the equivalent, you're not going to make any money.
But wouldn't that then be a self-reinforcing process? If those costs did go to the moon, as you say, then suddenly the mines shut down because they can't afford to sell their product. They can't mine their product, as we've seen here over the last 5 months. That leads to a supply issue and concern, which becomes an even stronger reinforcing process. Plus, we know that mining is a very energy intensive, and then refining even more energy intensive process. When you combine those processes, then you have a self-reinforcing eruption in the price of precious metals.
Well, I think it was around 2005 where the gold bugs had everything going. Weak U.S. dollar, a rising gold price, but hey, energy costs were going up and the gold mining business wasn't making any money. So this comes in on a business cycle basis, and you go back to what we do. You go from oversold to overbought. But just consider this, that through hundreds of years and wars and shortages and climate change and weather change and everything else, that on 4 out of 5 Great Depressions, the real price of gold went up by 1.7 times. The gold mining business was very profitable in a depression when other businesses were not profitable. And as a matter of fact, you've had the greatest gold rushes in history at or close to the end of a Great Depression when there were two things that prompted a gold rush. One, the real price of gold was very high. Two, employment was very low. Unemployment was very high. So guys went out and looked for gold. And this is as regular as you can get. So one doesn't need to have a forecast of 10,000 or 20,000. All one needs is a bit of history that says that when you're in a Great Depression, gold mining is going to become the premier industry.
We're both such history aficionados, and that's why I appreciate your perspective, because you've spun around the sun many more times than have I. But the statistics you're looking at are sound, but a bit skewed. There's some kurtosis in the statistical analysis. We're missing some really key anomalies in the data, and I'd like to interject a few. I mean, firstly, we have, of course, the overquoted Weimar, the recent Zimbabwe. We have much of South, if not all of South and Central America. And then we even have gold skyrocketing 100% in terms of rubles as the oil market crashed, careened out of control just about a year ago. We have some recent, very recent examples. Venezuela is another excellent example. The former communist bloc nations. Hungary actually holds the world record for inflation.
Well, the pango, yeah, I know. When you get huge paper inflation like the Weimar, you had virtually no credit market there. And they could go straight to printing, and we've all seen pictures of the wheelbarrows and that sort of stuff. But for consistency and research, you have to stay with the senior economy and the senior currency. And all I'm saying is that the record is that in the Great Depressions, the real price of gold goes up. And it makes the gold mining the premier industry. And that's not only sufficient, but it's necessary information. You don't need forecasts of $10,000 or $20,000 gold. That's fanciful stuff.
Anything over 100% is just unnecessary, because these things occur one step at a time. We're not going to wake up tomorrow with $2,000 gold, $5,000 the next day, $10,000. If we want to speak hypothetically or theoretically, that makes sense. But I'm with you. We need to stick with the empirical facts. And history does not support a global gold eruption of enormous proportions. So it puts the onus of responsibility on the shoulders of people who just haven't done their homework. And it also, I think, discourages people from having a diversified portfolio, which is the hallmark of investing success. Increasing one's weight in the precious metals sector, not a bad idea considering the five-year bear market we've been in. Would you agree with that?
You'd want, anybody should own some gold as insurance. When you're evaluating it in dollars, Canadian, U.S. dollars, or euros, or pangos, you're then becoming a currency trader. An investor in the precious metals sector will look at the stocks and look at whether the company is going to make any money or not. And then you add that up with our historical view that in the Great Depressions, the gold mining industry has made a lot of money. It's the only industry that you can predict will make money during a Great Depression. So that, you know, Chris, we don't need to know anything more than that.
Incidentally, how is the view? I think you mentioned you moved into a condo.
Actually, I was just closing the curtains because the sun was coming in. But I'm right on the Pacific Ocean here. I look south into the Washington state, and it's not clear enough to see them today, but there's a range of mountains there on the Olympic Peninsula. So I got out my map, did the scale, and it's 100 miles away. Now I can see in Washington state Mount Baker. Now that is a dormant volcano, and it's much higher elevation. And it's 80 miles away. So I love the view, Chris.
Given the circumference of the Earth being round and whatnot, you've just proven what Galileo proved.
What sailors knew from time immemorial. You're talking to someone who, when I was doing my degree in physics, had vaguely heard about a flat Earth society. And this was back in the 60s. And you could get membership in this if you could do a paper in physics that was absolute nonsense. They had this Flat Earth Society, and one of its ambitions was to bring up for debate at the United Nations General Assembly that the United Nations should build a wall around the edge of the world to prevent the ships from falling off. The response was, well, of course, the United Nations has debated a whole lot more sillier things than that. But, Chris, I'll leave you with the motto from the Flat Earth Society. We are on the level.
Thanks for your help, Bob.
Okay, anytime.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project. offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.